So this is the first Sunday of the new year that I'm here to teach. And in the beginning of the year, I like to mark the beginning with the talk on the Four Noble Truths, being so central and such a foundation to Buddhist teachings. And I'd like to first mention that when the Buddha was first awakened, when he first had his awakening under the Bodhi tree, he was reluctant to teach. And he felt that whatever it was that he had experienced, attained, whatever way he'd been changed by that experience, was somehow very difficult to convey. And the people wouldn't get it. So, as the legend goes, the god Brahma got wind of this. And I guess thought this was a real shame. The Buddha wasn't going to teach. So he came down and talked to the Buddha. And he said, you know, you should teach. And the Buddha said, looked around the world and realized, in fact, there were some people in the world who have but little dust in front of their eyes. So, and they could see. They'll be able to see or experience what he had to teach. And then he set forth to find some of these people that he knew had but little dust in front of their eyes. And the people he went first to find were five ascetics who had been his companions when he had been an ascetic. For some 6 years, the Buddha had engaged in the ascetic practices of India of his time. And it said that he virtually mastered them. And until he realized that mastering them would have meant death. To push the ascetic practice to that extreme, not eating and all kinds of things. And he didn't think that dying was going to help his spiritual quest. So at some point he decided to abandon those ascetic practices. And one of the things, one of the legends is that he then ate some very rich porridge that someone came and offered him. Made with cream or milk or something. And the his five companions, they were dismayed, were discouraged, were disgusted, were, you know, upset that he had abandoned his ascetic ways. And so they abandoned him and they left. So when the Buddha was going to go and find someone who had but little dust in front of their eyes, he thought of his five companions. And so he went for a long walk from Bodh Gaya to Varanasi, to Benares, where they were. And when he arrived there, his ex-companions saw him in the distance coming. And they said something like, "Oh, here comes that, I don't know exactly, but I remember exactly. Here comes that turncoat, or here comes that guy who, you know, has slipped, you know, slipped on the path or something. And let's just basically ignore him. Let's not talk to him. Let's not, you know, give him any heed." And when he walked up to them, there was something about his presence, something about his, the way he was, his manner, his countenance, his presence, is the way he was, where his companions couldn't help themselves but to stand up and make a seat for him and offer him to sit down. So their initial idea was to just ignore the guy. But when he showed up, they just said something about him made it impossible for them to do that. And they offered him a seat, and they kind of a bowl of water, I guess, to wash his feet, which was a custom. People walking barefoot in the dusty land. And then the Buddha said to them, "Look, you know, I am now a realized one, an enlightened one." And they said, "No, no. You know, someone who's, you know, go off and eating porridge. You know, I can't be that way. Kind of like my son. My son wouldn't believe it. Someone even oatmeal would get enlightened." And so he said, "No, no." And then the Buddha said, well, listen, you've known me for a long time, and have you ever known me to lie? And they said, no. You're an upright person. Well, listen to me. So they listened. And he gave his first teaching. That's called the teachings of turning the wheel of the Dharma. So here it is, a man who has some transformative experience, felt that it's hard to convey that to other people, and then he was going to try. He felt there was these people maybe he could understand. But there was something, the context of his teaching wasn't just philosophy. You know, if you read it, if you read the book, you know, you say, oh, you see those teachings, 1, 2, 3, 4. But the context for his first teaching is somehow was out in nature, probably sitting under a tree. These people are outdoors. And these people who didn't want to give him heed, and then felt something powerful enough that they offered him a seat and then listened to what he had to say. So that's the kind of the context for what he was about to teach. And what he taught was the Four Noble Truths. And that was how he chose to try to convey what he had realized. And the Four Noble Truths, the word noble is the word, basically in English, Aryan. Arya. Aryan. And it's a very unfortunate, well, not an unfortunate word, it's unfortunate what happened to the word in the 20th century. So it's kind of like can't be used anymore. You know, it's probably another 500 years or 1,000 years before many of us, you know, want to use it in some kind of easy way, favorable way. So usually translated into English as noble, partly because the Aryan race that came into India were kind of the noble caste of India at the time. So it's associated with nobility. But I think sometimes it's translated as holy. The word is something holy. It's probably the closest that in Buddhism you get to a word like sacred. Sacred, you know, is kind of a Western term, Latin word, right? And so we have our own associations with it. And it's a whole different religion over there in India. But probably what comes closest to that word is probably the word Arya, this word that's translated as noble. And I've known people who have translated it as the four sacred truths, or the four holy truths. And then we have people who react to the word truth because it's like a creed, like a belief, and a philosophy, a dogma. And I know one teacher who says that what makes these things true is that when the person who realizes the Four Noble Truths becomes a true person. So when you become a person who's true, then you realize the Four Noble Truths. So there's something to do with how you are. So here the Buddha showed up with his five ascetics, and something about him, maybe he had become a true person. His being was somehow truthful. In that first discourse, the Buddha did not present the Four Noble Truths as philosophy. He presented them as tasks or as practices to undertake. And so each of these Four Noble Truths represents a task that we can do. And so the question is, what is the task associated with each of these Four Noble Truths? So those of you who don't know about the Four Noble Truths, it's important to hear them, all four of them, simultaneously. So probably what we should have is I should invite three of the other of you up here, and then I would say the first, and this person, the second one, you say the second, and the third one would say the third, and the third and fourth, and you'd all say it, you know, all at the same time, so that you would understand that they're integrated together. But since I'm one person here up here, I can only say one sentence at a time, and so you say usually the first one first. But the problem with that is it gives some kind of prominence to the first one that it's easy to get to react to, or it's easy to get maybe the wrong idea. But if you could hear all four at the same time, then there's a different kind of feeling of what's being done here. So you have to imagine you're hearing all together. So the first one is simply the truth that suffering exists, that there is suffering. That's all. That's all it is. And it's pretty hard to argue with that. I know some people try to. But, you know, it's kind of a little bit hard. So suffering exists. You know, you kind of know it when you're feeling somehow you're in pain, psychological pain, physical pain. You kind of know it. And then, so just that, just a statement of kind of fact. Maybe it's subjective fact, it's something you experience, but still, we experience suffering. And then there is the truth of the arising of suffering. Suffering doesn't just appear. It's not just there because it just doesn't spontaneously arise. It just, you know, or it's not innate. It's not something like necessarily that we're, you know, comes from beginningless time and just always there, we're born with it or something. It arises because of certain conditions being present. The ground for it. And the arising of suffering, the ground for that suffering, is said to be clinging or craving. A certain kind of compulsive and driven quality in our mind. And you know that driven quality, I think, at those times, it's very clear, those times when you have some kind of drive, some kind of strong emotional reaction that you feel maybe is not so healthy to have, and you find it hard to let go of it. And you feel that, how driven, how compulsive it might be. So there's the truth of suffering, and then there's the truth of the arising of that suffering. And here, the correlation is that suffering does not arise without a cause. That cause, I think, is understood to be something that's happening now, in the present moment. Both the cause, the conditions might have been in the past, but the cause is in the present. The conditions for why we cling, hold on tight, might have to do with things that happened in our past. But the clinging is happening in the present. So both the suffering and the cause have to do with now. And that's one of the reasons why in Buddhism we put a lot of emphasis on showing up into the present moment so we can really see these things. So the truth of suffering, the truth of the rising of suffering, and then there's the truth of the cessation. It's called the truth of cessation, which is the truth of the end, of the truth of ending clinging and entering the suffering that comes from that clinging. So there's a possibility of somehow dropping, eliminating, stopping, putting an end to the clinging, the craving, the grasping, the attachment. And when that craving and grasping is eliminated or put to rest, the suffering that comes out of it will not arise anymore. So as I like to reword it, if you cling, you will suffer. If you let go of that clinging, that suffering will end. So there's a truth of cessation. And then there's a fourth truth, which is a truth of the path leading to that cessation. And that is the truth that recognizes that even though it's not so easy to do this, it's easy to say, oh, just let go of your attachment. And some of you probably have been insulted by people who say, oh, just let go. You know, as if it's easy to do. But it's some things are easy and some things are quite difficult. And because some things are difficult, it helps to create the conditions, the appropriate conditions, the ground, the soil, where release can blossom, can bloom. And so we have the Eightfold Path, the truth, and this is called, so there's eight steps. So that's the four truths. Now, with each of those truths, there's a task connected to it. And so the first truth, the task is to understand suffering. And that's bad news, right? Because you have to experience it. It's experience it to understand it. It isn't to understand it philosophically, abstractly. It isn't that you read some kind of book about, you know, all the different aspects of suffering and then think you understand it. But to realize it means you have to realize it in yourself, for yourself. So the Buddhist bumper sticker is, I stop for suffering. So if you suffer, you stop and you look at it. You get to know it. And it's very important to do that. Because if you don't do it, even if you can let go easily, it's actually sometimes better not to let go too quickly, so that you can spend time hanging out with your suffering and really understand it well. As human beings, we often kind of want to get over our suffering quickly. Just anything, please. I don't want to look at it. I just don't want to have it. I'm uncomfortable. I think it's actually very wise to be willing to stay uncomfortable for a while. And part of, I think, the training of mindfulness practice is a training that, among other things, trains you how to be comfortable or at ease with discomfort. Isn't that nice? Comfortable with discomfort. So that you can really get to know it well, really see it well. If you just kind of push it away quickly, you won't see it. So the first task is to see, understand well the suffering. And some of it, each of us probably has, you know, our top 10 list of, you know, our suffering and certain tendencies, certain ways and things that repeat themselves over and over again, and certain demons that follow us along. And so here you're asked to actually stop and look at it, really take time. And there's many ways of doing that. It could be done in meditation, it could be done talking with a friend, asking your friend, can I just explore this with you? And it could be done in journaling, it could be done, you know, all kinds of ways. And being creative about that, I think, is helpful. Now, there's a wonderful teacher named Ajahn Jumyan, a Thai teacher, and he says there is ordinary suffering and there's holy suffering or sacred suffering. And you know the difference? The difference is that they're exactly the same kind of suffering, but the difference is when you engage with your suffering as the First Noble Truth, when you engage it as part of this path, then you've made it sacred. But if you just suffer just the old-fashioned way, then it's ordinary. So there's actually meant to be some dignity and some hope in looking at our suffering. There's something very special that happens when you stop and look and really be with it carefully. And the suggestion, I think, of the Ajahn Jumyan is somehow it becomes sacred or holy or noble when you actually engage with it in this kind of way. But you have to bring yourself, something's required of you to make it sacred. The suffering is not sacred or ordinary, independent of you. It's what you bring to it, how you understand it, how you hold it. So the first task is to understand suffering. Now remember, you have to hold all four of these together. Otherwise, you might get getting depressed now. What? I have to experience it more, my suffering? The second truth is the truth, of the arising, the cause. And here, the task is to abandon it, to let go of the clinging, of the grasping. Let go of what we grasp to, and let go of the grasping itself. So we grasp to pleasure. We have aversion to displeasure, which is kind of grasping. We grasp to our opinions, our views, our stories. I think a huge underappreciated form of clinging is clinging to stories. We tell ourselves, we're human beings, are story-making creatures. And then we cling to those stories. Stories about our past, stories about our future, stories about other people, sometimes called opinions, views. We cling to those. And then we cling to self, to self-image, to how we want to hold, how we want to see ourselves, identify ourselves. And so when you study suffering, you start understanding where the clinging is. That's part of the reason we study suffering, to really understand where the clinging is. And I have been totally perplexed sometimes. I know I suffer, and I just can't identify where the clinging is. Or I can't identify it well enough. Where is it? What is it that I have to do with? Where is it? It's not always so easy. Until I've been with it long enough, or until I've gotten concentrated enough or still enough, or it sometimes takes a lot of work. But sooner or later, the task, the second of truth, is to let go of that clinging. And there's many ways letting go happens. Sometimes it happens because you do something that releases. Sometimes it releases itself and you don't have anything to do with it. And sometimes it takes, a lot of different things need to happen depending on the nature of that clinging. So it's not a necessarily easy task, but it's a worthwhile task, an ennobling task. So to learn how to let go in some deep way. The third task, the third noble truth, is to realize the cessation. So it's a little bit different. On one hand, you let go. So if I hold really tight to the striker, so hard and tight that, I start damaging my knuckles. After a while, I might realize, this is not a good idea. And so I think I better let go. But I need to be I'm attached to being a really good striker holder. It's important everybody see me as a good striker holder. So I can't just let go of holding the striker until see that what I'm really attached to is I want all of you to recognize what a good striker holder I am. And when I see that, then maybe at some point I can let go, I can release. So there's the release that happens, letting go, the abandoning, letting go. And then with that abandoning, there's the cessation, what's technically called the cessation of the clinging, of the suffering. But that cessation, from clinging to this striker, the cessation of clinging creates something new. If I let go of it, it creates something new, and that is, now my hand is open. My hand is relaxed. It's at ease. It feels the breeze, the coolness. And it's available to shake your hand, to do all kinds of things. It's available now. So the word cessation is a negative. It's the absence of something. But it doesn't really point to how wonderful it is. Maybe they get a sense of how wonderful it is. You remember that the five ascetics had to stand when the Buddha appeared. That somehow the Buddha was someone who realized the cessation of suffering, of clinging. And that made him somehow so different from how his companions knew him from the past, that they felt moved to stand up and offer him a seat. Somehow, when we no longer are conflicted or apologetic about ourselves or diminishing ourselves, or we're no longer driven and always want something and grabbing something and have an agenda, but somehow can just be present, let go of all the drivenness, all the compulsions, and offer a kind of presence. Be present in an unconflicted way. It's really special. If a person is really living a hectic life, those people sometimes around here work 80 hours a week. And then they're busy running around, doing this and that, dashing home, trying to take care of whatever's done at home. They're hardly getting any sleep, running around, wanting this. It's all in the pursuit of money and fame and status, and just running around like crazy. Zipping and zapping, this way and that, in my way. And finally, something happens, like the internet closes down. Finally, shouldn't there be an internet holiday? National internet holiday. So the internet closes down and the person is home and there's nothing to do. And so the person just sits in the chair and looks out the window and says, wow, this is peaceful. You know, just to sit quietly, not doing it, not running around all the time. This is actually peaceful. This is very nice. Thank you. So they sit there quietly enjoying that peace for a little while. And then the person notices, wait a minute, you know, I'm kind of peaceful, it's nice here, but you know, my mind is still racing. I'm still thinking about all the project things I have to do and this and that, and I seem to be thinking of four or five different things in the course of 10 seconds, you know, just jumping around and all these things, and this is like, you know, this is crazy. This is actually kind of painful. But because the person sat still long enough and had the peace of sitting still, they could see how busy the mind was. And so the person says, you know, well, maybe I should meditate. And so the person meditates a little bit. And some of all the kind of drivenness of the mind, of jumping around all these projects, thinking about plannings and all that, settles down. And goes, oh, this is feel peaceful. My mind is really peaceful. This is great. It feels happy. And then continues like that for a little while. And then after a while realizes, you know something? It's pretty peaceful compared to where it used to be. But I keep having basically a recurring thought over and over again about how afraid I am. I seem to be, fear seems to be constantly there. Faces, always this fear is kind of there on the edges of my mind all the time, and then they feel, oh, there's this fear. And so the person looks at the fear, and perhaps the fear relaxes, breathes with the fear, gets concentrated, and the fear fades away. And the person, oh, this is peaceful now, this is nice, this is really great. No more fear. And the person sits for a while like that and then realizes, oh, I keep thinking about myself all the time. I'm not afraid, but I'm just constantly thinking about myself, just thinking about myself, thinking about myself, thinking about myself. I'm not jumping around a lot, but I'm just, you know, I'm staying focused now on this. And it's more subtle than the fear, but it's always self here. It's self-concern. And it's, I'm getting tired of it. You know, I've been doing it now for long enough, I mean, tired is tired. Why doesn't I just shut up in there? And so maybe the person kind of sits up straight and takes more of a warrior approach and says, enough. I'm going to stop this selfing. And lo and behold, it stops. Oh, that's much more peaceful, thank you. Oh, that's nice. So what I'm describing is that you can experience peace, certain level of peace, and then you realize once you stabilize that level of peace that there are other activities of the mind, other things going on that somehow are uncomfortable, agitating, and you settle that, and oh, that's peaceful. Get used to that peace and you realize there's actually more agitation, it's more subtle, and then you address that and it settles more and more. And so each of those agitations is a form of suffering, and each of those represents some kind of clinging. And each of them represents a possibility of letting go of that and then attaining a deeper peace or a greater peace. And that peace of letting go, that peace of, in Buddhism, is often associated with being happy, with a certain kind of happiness. So it's peace is the greatest happiness. And what the Buddha was trying to do with the five ascetics is that he knew that they had little dust in front of their eyes. He knew that they had done a lot of spiritual practice. They are people, maybe ascetic practices are not so effective in the long run, but in the short term, ascetic practices can require a person to be purified, to be cleansed of a lot of attachments. If you're attached to sensual pleasure and sexuality, and you're being a celibate ascetic, you're either going to be unhappy or you're going to let go. And so they probably had let go. If they were attached to money and big houses, houses on steroids, then, you know, they probably worked through that. Probably those ascetics didn't care about that anymore. And so they'd worked through a lot. They didn't have a lot of attachments left. And then they heard this teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And one of them then was able to turn that around, the teachings, and find what was left in his psyche around attachment or clinging. And one of those five ascetics said his Dharma eye opened. So that's, you know, is that a good success rate for the Buddha? One in five? And so the cessation, even it's a word in the negative, leads to an awesome kind of peace, to be at peace. And to find that peace, to actually do the work of going deeper and deeper into the psyche, to really find out how deeply can we find a level of peace within us. And the kind of the paradox a little bit is that the world is pretty big. You know, you can drive around all these freeways we have in the Bay Area. It's been a lot of times a big world. And then you sit down and you close your eyes to meditate and your world's gotten smaller. But as you kind of go in a sense, and start experiencing the peace that's inside, or the peace that's possible, it opens up again. It's kind of like an hourglass. The world is big, and the inner world of peace is big, and actually, the inner world of peace is even bigger than the world. It's just awesomely awesome. So to really kind of plump, into, you know, it's not, you're not diminishing yourself, but actually you become immense and huge in the process, boundaryless. And then the task of the fourth noble truth is to develop the path, to develop these qualities, develop what's called right view, develop our intentionality or motivation. And to use Western, kind of common, very important Western term, to develop our will. I don't know if it works so well for Buddhism, but to develop a sense of will or intentionality, motivation. To develop our speech, so we speak in a way that's wise and harmonious with the practice. Right action, we behave and act in wise ways. Right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and then finally right concentration. So even though the second task is letting go, there's also a place, a very important place in Buddhism, of picking up, of developing oneself. And so in order to let go well, you also have to develop yourself. And so that's the Eightfold Path, the part of development. So they go in tandem. And sometimes I kind of liken it to that of a snake shedding its skin. The snake, I think, has to grow bigger, and then it sheds the old skin. So we have to grow bigger. We have to develop ourselves, develop strengths. And as we do that, then we'll have the capacity to let go more. So four tasks. And then there's one more thing about the Four Noble Truths. There's understanding the Four Noble Truths. There's the doing the task of the Four Noble Truths. And then there's understanding that the task has been done. It's not meant to be an endless task. You're always doing this task. Always on your to-do list. But you're supposed to actually come to a point where the task has been complete. You've done it. And the Buddha was someone who's done the task. So there's realizing you've done what had to be done in terms of understanding suffering, done what had to be done in terms of releasing clinging, done what had to be done in terms of cessation, letting go, done what had to be done in terms of developing the path. And what you get then is four sets of three. The first, the Four Noble Truths, which is four. The four tasks connected to the Four Noble Truths, which is four. And then the four, you know, understandings that it's been done. The completion of each four, which is four. And you get, so you get 12 total. And some of you might have seen the 12 spoke Dharma wheel. And those 12 spokes are supposed to represent those 12 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. And when you have 12 spokes to a wheel, it's a really strong wheel. And it can roll really well. And so when the Buddha gave his first teaching to those five ascetics, it said that he set the wheel of the Dharma in motion. And that wheel, that the wheel has been rolling ever since. And some time ago, it rolled right into Redwood City. And it's really up to us then to continue allowing that wheel to roll by our engagement in these Four Noble Truths. So from a Buddhist point of view, if you want to make your life sacred, so that life comes sacred in the application of the Four Noble Truths. And if you want to discover the deepest kind of peace that's possible, it's through the application of the Four Noble Truths. So that's for the beginning of the year. And my hope is in that reminding you or teaching you about the Four Noble Truths, you will provide you with inspiration, encouragement to wholeheartedly engage yourself in the practice for this coming year. Thank you.